You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As much as we may not want to admit it, the latest neuroscience research has discovered that our minds can make up memories that don't exist, and yes, that we often choose to buy detergent based on how the box looks. It's the subject of Leonard Mlodinow's latest book, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior, published by Pantheon Books. I'm very pleased to welcome Leonard Mlodinow back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks.
Now, you received your PhD in theoretical physics. When did you become interested in social neuroscience?
Well,
is there a quantum theory involved here somewhere?
No, there is not. There are a lot of physicists, biophysicists, who work in neuroscience, and it's really a hot, exciting new area. And so I got interested in neuroscience first. And when I started looking at the unconscious, something really interesting struck me, which is that my last book, or at least my last solo book, was The Drunkard's Walk on Randomness. And in that book, I talked about how you misinterpret your external world if you don't understand randomness. Things happen and you don't really understand what's behind them. And I realized that due to not understanding the unconscious mind, we misinterpret our internal world. So I thought this would be a great companion book to the other, because it tells you that a lot of your social perceptions and the way you judge and interact with other people is not quite going the way you think it is, because there are hidden forces behind it.
Well, you're using the word unconscious, but the title of your book is Subliminal. Do the words subliminal, unconscious, and subconscious all mean the same thing?
Well, unconscious and subconscious are somewhat interchangeable, and
it
also
depends
non-conscious.
Depends on whether you're Freudian or Jungian. Is that
well? So they call it today the new unconscious, to distinguish it from those, because Freud and Jung and others popularized the unconscious mind, and they had their theories, and through the 20th century that really became established in our culture. But this unconscious that I'm talking about and that neuroscientists talk about today is much different. It's not hidden from you due to motivational forces, and it can't be revealed through therapy. It's unconscious. It's outside of your awareness, because it takes place in parts of your brain that are inherently outside of your awareness and can't be tapped into by your conscious mind.
So how do you test for it?
Well, you can do behavioral testing to see effects that people aren't aware of. And you can also today, thanks to a new invention called functional magnetic resonance imaging, you can look inside the brain and you can see the actual organs in the brain light up at work in real time as people are experiencing the world.
Was Freud the first person to suggest the power of the unconscious mind?
No, not at all. But Freud was, there were a group of scientists in the late 19th century who talked about it quite a bit. Freud is the one who rose out of that pack, I guess, to reach our, to become a cultural icon. But through most of the 20th century, research psychologists and scientists avoided the talk of the unconscious altogether.
Because they saw Freud as unscientific?
Well, part of it is that they saw Freud. Freud was unscientific. He started out as
he started out as
a scientist, and he did good work. But he became a clinician, and he created all his theories based on interacting with other people. But he didn't do experiments. But the scientists who did experiments in the 20th century weren't seeing these effects, and they were studying other effects.
So where do you draw the line between something like the unconscious, which is scientific, and a sense of spirituality?
Well, the unconscious is something that you study by making hypotheses and doing experiments and making predictions and testing your predictions. And spirituality is a philosophical issue. It's how you feel about how you what your own intuition is about the way the universe is. But
it seems to come out of the unconscious, doesn't it?
Some spirituality, of course. My point in the book Subliminal is that most of your behavior comes out of and is affected to a great extent by your unconscious.
Now, the brain is divided into two cerebral hemispheres. Each of them has four lobes. Do we know where the unconscious is located? Is it spread all over the place?
Well, it is complicated, but there are certain parts of your brain called the limbic system, for instance, that are very important in unconscious feelings of emotion. There are parts of your brain called the hippocampus, the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the amygdala is probably something your listeners may have heard of. So these are parts of your brain that are key to your unconscious processes.
You quote a well-known neuroscientist as saying he'd like to believe he knows how the process works, but he has, quote, no conscious access to it, no matter how much he introspects. That's because, obviously, because the unconscious works subliminally. You can't really have access to it, can you?
Well, that's what scientists believe today, that you cannot. But Freudians and many people through the 20th century thought that you could.
Well, through dreams and things like that.
Through dreams or through therapy.
And the way you, whether you acted in a neurotic way and what that suggested about how your subconscious affected your conscious activities.
Right, but the new unconscious is the observation that your brain really constructs its view of reality. Let's take your vision, for instance. What you're looking at me right now, what you're seeing a clear picture of me, and you're seeing a three-dimensional picture of me in your conscious mind. But of course, your retina only picks up a two-dimensional image. And in fact, the image your retina is picking up is very pixelated. It's extremely fuzzy around the outside. It has a hole near the middle where your optic nerve attaches to the retina. But your brain takes all that incomplete and imperfect data and processes it and gives you a picture that looks clear and real. And you think it's real, and you don't have to focus on creating it. It is done for you. It's done automatically. And the point is that scientists are discovering is that this happens also in your memory. You remember the gist of things, but you fill in the details when you call the memory to your conscious mind, and it happens in your social perception, the way you judge people, the way you judge yourself, the way you judge products, the way you just judge stocks. Our whole perception, both socially and of the physical world, is created in your mind. It's constructed using real data, but also using context, your prior beliefs, your expectations, your desires. And so this means that the way you perceive everything in the world, in the social world that we interact, is not necessarily what's really there.
Well, we all know that sometimes we misremember things, but you were talking about memory. But there's an example in your book about people remembering having seen Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, even though he's not a Disney character.
Yes, that's called a false memory. And when I give talks, I sometimes give a little demonstration that's kind of fun. I read about 12 words. Most of the words have to do with sweetness. Some of them don't. And then I blabber on for another minute to go on to something else. And then I come back to the words and I ask the audience and I give them three words and I say, which of these three words did you hear? Or maybe it was more than one. And one of them was actually on the list. It's the word taste. And one of them wasn't on the list. And they get about half of them get taste, and most of them don't think that they heard the one that wasn't on the list. But there's another one, sweet. And about as many people, about half the audience, think they heard the word sweet. Even though I say, don't raise your hand unless you're absolutely certain, unless you're very confident that you've heard this word. You can hear it in your head, me saying the word. And they think they do. And that's because what you remember is a generality, and then you fill in those specifics. And so scientists with this Bugs Bunny character, they've done experiments where they take kids and their parents into a room, and they show them ads for a Disney World, and they have them read the copy, and they talk about Bugs Bunny being there, and then later they ask them about their memories of Disney World, Disneyland, and this comes into their mind because their mind is filling it in based on the expectation, based on the ad that they had previously read.
Now, there's nothing dangerous in that, but it can be a serious problem, for example, when people are testifying about a crime that they have witnessed.
Well, it is a serious problem, and there are many examples of that where what happens is when you witness a crime, unless the person who's committing the crime is someone you know, you remember their face in the same way. You remember the gist of their face, certain features, a certain look, and then you fill it in when you have to recall it. Now, if the police happen to be putting in front of you some pictures, one of which resembles somewhat the gist of the face that you saw, you can make the mistake and fill in that person's face. And remember I said that when you're doing this filling in, whether it's visual or it's in memory, you use prior beliefs, context, and other things to fill it in. Well, the context here is the police think that these guys are suspects, and you see one that not consciously but unconsciously resembles the person you saw. Your mind can fill that in, and you can be convinced that that's the person, and that's happened many times. And thanks to DNA testing now, we can actually go back many times and see that and identify those problems and exonerate the people. Before, we couldn't do that. But that's how we know how often this happens, and it happens quite often.
And sometimes people even remember that they did things that they didn't do.
Well, there's one very, really interesting experiment to show how easy it is to plant false memories. They take 20 somethings into a room, and they had talked to their family previously and gathered photographs of them. And one of the photographs they take, and they doctor, and they put that person in a balloon, and they show it to the they're showing the subject of the experiment all these pictures, and asking the person, "Oh, do you remember this when you were a kid? Do you remember that?" And when they come to the balloon one, they don't. They say, "No, I don't remember that." And then they let them go, and they let them go away, and they bring them back a couple months later, and now they show them the same pictures. And now when they see the balloon, they go, "Yeah, I remember that ride." Mm-hmm. And it happens in about, I think, 20% of the individuals. It's that easy to implant a false memory.
And does that then become something that's a firm memory, something that would be hard to shake?
Well, I don't know of any studies that test, again, about how to shake it once you've implanted it, but it's as firm as any other of the childhood memories that they have.
My guest is Leonard Mlodinow, who teaches at the California Institute of Technology and has written a number of books. The one we're discussing is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. When do we make decisions that are based on our unconscious mind? Do we make them as often as we make them with our conscious mind?
Well, your mind consists of many modules that work in parallel and are highly interconnected. So it's not that you're making a decision now based on your conscious and another time based on your unconscious, but your conscious mind is always being fed in by your unconscious mind.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to give an example. Suppose you're going to buy wine, and you go to a store, and there's German wine and there's French wine. Well, you may go with a conscious intention to buy either one or the other because you know what you like, but they've done studies to show how your unconscious can affect that. For instance, they play music in the store. There's a store in England that agreed to play French and German music on alternate days, and they found that people bought about 65% of the people chose the French wine on the days the French music played, and about the same number chose the German wine on the days that the German music played. And then the experimenters would watch these people and interview them after their purchase, and very few of them remembered even hearing the music. But the music set a certain mood, and their unconscious mind reacted to that and influenced their decision, which they thought was a conscious decision based on their prior preferences.
This is almost like Vance Packard stuff.
Yeah. Well, Vance Packard wrote a book in the 50s, and he mentioned
We became paranoid as a result
because he was warning about how this could be used against us. And neuromarketers today are trying to figure that out using the latest science. But what Packard was talking, one of the study that was really scary was actually a hoax that was done by a marketing consultant named Vickery, who claimed that he was flashing subliminal images of drink Coca-Cola or eat popcorn during a film, and that increased sales of Coke and popcorn. And he later, 5 years later, admitted that that was a hoax. But today, ironically, we can do that, replicate that in the lab, and we find that there is a little effect, and you can actually get people to change the prep or to, let's say, choose Lipton iced tea after the experiment as opposed to a soda if you had flashed subliminally the words Lipton iced tea before their eyes. But that effect, that literal classic subliminal effect, is very weak. If they really don't like the iced tea, they're not going to do it. And if you wait an hour later, they're still not going to do it. But the interesting thing is that there are subliminal things going on all around us that do affect us, like the grocery store study I mentioned, that are more robust than that.
And we'll come back to the grocery stores and the restaurants and a lot of other things after we take a little break. My guest is – oh, okay, I'm not going to take a break. So let's talk about grocery stores. Supermarkets now offer vine tomatoes. When I was a kid, it was all the stuff in the plastic wrap. Do vine tomatoes in any way make us want to buy them more? Do we think that they're more authentic?
Well, sure they do. Even the way you describe the tomatoes as vine tomatoes can make you buy them more often. Researchers have found that, for instance, when you the way that restaurants describe food on a menu affects not just the amount of ordering of that item, but in later surveys, the amount of enjoyment of that item. So you'll enjoy velvety mashed potatoes more than you would enjoy mashed potatoes.
Last night, my waiter made a point to call them smashed potatoes. And we were amused. On the other hand, we understood that they were trying to tell us something about the kind of restaurant it was.
A violent one, I guess.
No, that it wasn't just your cliche mashed potatoes. You also say crispy cucumbers.
Crispy cucumbers. Yeah, well, who would say limp cucumbers? But it's more than just the information that's imparted by saying crispy. It's the image. And it really has a subliminal effect, because they find that that if you feed people the identical food described differently, they will later report their reports of enjoyment will be higher later when it was described in a more appetizing way.
How can the new unconscious relate to other fields of science and social sciences? First of all, do we think about it in terms of evolution?
Oh, very much so. I mentioned earlier a parallel between the way we construct our vision from limited data, and I said that there are analogous things going on in your social perception. Well, the way our brain works didn't evolve for our society that we sit in today with cars, automobiles, technology, but it evolved thousands, many thousands of years ago when we lived in the wild. And so the purpose of our unconscious processes is to help us survive in the wild. And the reason that these unconscious processes are so important in our social life is that humans are inherently a very, very social animal. In fact, the most advanced socially of any animal. There are other animals. We all know that bees and ants live in societies. Some moles live in societies. Other primates live in societies as well. But we have by far the most complex society with the most complex interactions, and the interactions between the most individuals of any other species, and that was really very important to our survival.
There's something called theory of mind, and aren't they scientists now trying to figure out whether all primates have a theory of mind?
So theory of mind means that we all form theories of what other people are thinking, and beyond that, we form theories of what they are thinking, we're thinking, and we even form theories of what they're thinking, we're thinking, that they're thinking, and so on. And when scientists examine this, they examine how deeply we can understand how other people are thinking.
Well, and, on the one hand, it can allow us to understand the social interaction, to even manipulate people. But in other cases, it could lead to paranoia, couldn't it? In all of this, does the subconscious of somebody who is troubled psychologically play a more powerful role in how they act?
Well, if someone has a psychological disorder, it's often connected to their brain, structure and their brain chemistry. So there are physiological illnesses brain abnormalities that cause schizophrenia and other illnesses and autism.
Autistic people really don't try to think about what's going on in the next.
Well, theory of mind is very closely related to autism, and neuroscientists that look at the brain, they can see that there are abnormalities in the parts of the brain that are responsible for theory of mind. Oliver Sacks wrote about an individual who, Temple Grandin, I think, who said, described when she was on the playground with other kids, they seemed like aliens to her because she didn't have theory of mind. So she looked at other individuals that were humans, other kids would understand why they're doing and what they're thinking and what they're doing. And she had no idea. She was like looking at some animal that she had never seen before. And scientists have found that theory of mind, even in kids, is extremely important. That when they test kids, they found a strong correlation between the child's popularity and success in school and their the sophistication of their own theory of mind, the way their understanding of other children. So it starts, this is very important very early in life and continues to be important throughout our lives.
Listeners have been writing in. I'm going to read some of these questions. Are different people ruled by their unconscious minds to varying degrees?
Well, I think the basis of the influence of your unconscious is the same for all of us, because it's part of our architecture as a human being. I think that one of the reasons I wrote subliminal was because your conscious mind can, if you become aware of your unconscious influences, can overrule them and alter them. So it's a matter, in a sense, of raising your consciousness. Let me give you an example. There have been studies showing that think about the stock market, and here we are in New York, and we have all these fancy analysts. Well, they ask this question. We all know that we're in a better mood when it's sunny, and we're in a worse mood when it's really a bad overcast day. So they looked at 20 years of the stock market, I think, from about 1975 to 95, and they looked at the weather reports, and they pulled out the days that were completely sunny in New York City and the days that were completely crappy. And And they said, let's look at the difference in the stock market. So these people are coming in with all their quantitative analysis. And are they being unconsciously affected by something irrelevant, such as the weather? And they found that the market went up about 24% on the purely sunny days and about 8%, annualized, that is, and about only about 8% on the bad days.
Because they were feeling more optimistic.
Because their mood was different. They weren't aware of it. Now, if you become aware of it, it's unconscious effects are automatic. So you automatically feel, you might feel more optimistic about a stock. And the challenge is to become aware of that and use your conscious mind to make you become more rigorous in your analysis and ignore what you know are your emotions that are affecting you.
But some people get past that. Maybe they're the better analysts.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know of any study where they differentiated between different analysts. But I think it is possible to get past that. And the best way to do that is to try and understand the effects.
A listener asks about people who lie so much, wonders if they believe their own lies.
Well, I didn't address lying too much in the book because that's generally a conscious thing. But I do know that people lie a lot more than people understand that they do. And it's usually conscious. And there are usually unconscious signs of the lie on your face.
But we also lie to ourselves.
We also lie to ourselves. Well, one way we lie to ourselves is to inflate our own self-image. And we all have a very important unconscious tendency to think of ourselves in a good light. And that's very important because it helps us to accomplish things that we might not otherwise be able to accomplish. And in fact, the people who have the most realistic view of themselves are depressed people. So it's not necessarily
Thanks a
good thing. But it's something to be aware of because when we, for instance, there's a political election going on, and when we look at political issues, there's two ways of looking at an issue. One is the way of the scientist, where you gather the data and you draw the conclusion. And the other is the way of an attorney, where you know the conclusion you want and you gather data to support it. Well, it turns out that people have a natural proclivity to be the attorney. If you believe in the death penalty, and now you're looking at studies that either criticize or support the death penalty, studies have shown that you will automatically tend to, in your mind, without even intending to do it, you will tend to debunk in your mind the methodology that leads to the studies whose conclusions you don't like, and to accept more blindly the methodology of the studies that you like, even if you're trying hard not to. Let me just give you one example. Researchers took subjects and assigned them a role in a accident case. It was a motorcycle versus a car. The motorcyclist was suing the automobile driver. And they said they gave them all the information from the trial and the transcript, and they paired them off to negotiate their own settlement. They said it's between $0 and $100,000. And then they said, just before they started, though, after they had read all the information, they said, we want to take a pause in this experiment, and here's a challenge. I want you to tell me what you think the fair number is that the judge really arrived at. Take off your hat of being the advocate. Put on your hat of being the objective viewer, and let's see what you come up with. Well, the people who had been assigned, even though the assignment was just for an experiment, but the people who were assigned to represent the motorcyclists, they guessed that $40,000 was a fair settlement, and those who were assigned to represent the car driver guessed $20,000. So this motivated reasoning, this tendency to digest the data in a way that's biased because of your goal, they couldn't even get past that when they were going to get a cash award if they came within $5,000 of the right answer.
We have very little time, but I want to address a couple of things, and maybe we can make it quick. One is that you point out that we're attracted to people who share our surname, but also there is such a thing that people talk about as love at first sight. I would suggest that we also dislike people at first sight. And how much does the unconscious play? How much of a role does the unconscious play in all of that?
Well, it plays a very large role because when you know someone very well, you form a pretty accurate picture based on real data. When you don't know someone very well, then it's like the picture I was describing earlier on your retina, where you have a few pixels here and a few pixels there, and you have to fill in. So when you first meet someone and you don't have a lot of data, you nevertheless have a feeling about the person, which is an extrapolation from the little data that you do have. It could be that they remind you of someone that you love. It could be that their smile connects with you. It could be that they have a look of competence on them, and you read that as that being a real intellectual trait rather than just a look on their face. So when people first interact, whether it's love or hate at first sight, it is very connected to that.
And a bunch of listeners have asked you about your opinion on free will.
My opinion on free will. Okay, well.
Nothing is free, right? There's no free will. There's no free lunch.
Not even free will is free. Well, as a scientist, I believe that free will is something that we feel and that we feel that we have, but that everything that you do is governed by the laws of nature and the laws of physics, and there is nothing outside, nothing that you do that comes from any effect that's outside the laws we learn in physics class.
Leonard Mlodinow teaches at the California Institute of Technology. His previous books include 3 New York Times bestsellers, War of the Worldviews, which he wrote with Deepak Chopra, The Grand Design with Stephen Hawking, and The Drunkard's Walk. And now he has written Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. It is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks. It was great to be here.